"Forgive me, Elida Sedai," Nynaeve said, dropping another curtsy, "but I was about to go out. I have much to catch up in my studies. If you will forgive..." "Your studies can wait," Elida said. "They have waited long enough already, after all." She plucked the cloth bag out of Nynaeve's hands and undid the strings, but after one glance inside, she tossed it on the floor. "Herbs. You are not a village wisdom any longer, child. Trying to hold on to the past will only hold you back."
"Elida Sedai," Elaine said, "I..."
"Be silent, novice." Elida's voice was cold and soft, as silk wrapped around steel is soft. "You may have broken a bond between Tar-Valon and Camelin that has lasted 3,000 years. You will spoke when spoken to." Elaine's eyes examined the floor in front of her toes. Spots of color burned in her cheeks. Guilt or anger? Egwene was not sure. Ignoring them all, Elida sat down in one of the chairs, carefully arranging her skirts. She made no gesture for the rest of them to sit. Nynaeve's face tightened, and she began giving sharp little tugs to her braid. Egwene hoped she would keep her temper well enough not to take the other chair without permission. When Elida had settled herself to her own satisfaction, she studied them for a time in silence, her face unreadable. At last she said, "Did you know that we have the Black Aja among us?" Egwene exchanged startled glances with Nynaeve and Elaine.
"We were told," Nynaeve said cautiously.
"Elida Sedai," she added after a pause. Elida arched an eyebrow.
"Yes, I thought that you might know of it."
Egwene gave a start at her tone, implying so much more than it said, and Nynaeve opened her mouth angrily, but the Aes Sedai's flat stare stilled tongues. "The two of you," Elida went on in a casual tone, "vanish, taking with you the daughter heir of Andor, the woman who may become queen of Andor one day, if I do not strip off her hide and sell it to a glove maker. Vanish without permission, without a word, without a trace."
"I was not carried off," Elaine said to the floor. "I went of my own will."
"Will you obey me, child?" A glow surrounded Elida. The Aes Sedai's glare was fixed on Elaine. "Must I teach you here and now?" Elaine raised her head, and there was no mistaking what was in her face. Anger. For a long moment she met Elida's stare. Egwene's fingernails dug into her palms. It was maddening. She or Elaine or Nynaeve could destroy Elida where she sat. If they caught Elida by surprise, at least, she was fully trained after all.
"And if we do anything but take whatever she wants to feed us, we throw away everything. Don't throw it away now, Elaine."
Elaine's head dropped.
"Forgive me, Elida Sedai," she mumbled. "I forgot myself."
The glow winked out of existence, and Elida sniffed audibly.
"You have learned bad habits wherever these two took you. You cannot afford bad habits, child. You will be the first queen of Andor ever to be Aes Sedai. The first queen anywhere to be Aes Sedai in over 1,000 years. You will be one of the strongest of us since the breaking of the world. Perhaps strong enough to be the first ruler since the breaking to openly tell the world she is Aes Sedai. Do not risk all of that, child, because you can still lose it all. I have invested too much time to see that. Do you understand me?"
"I think so, Elida Sedai," Elaine said. She sounded as if she did not understand at all. No more did Egwene. Elida abandoned the subject.
"You may be in grave danger, all three of you. You disappear and return, and in the interval, Leandrin and her companions leave us. There will inevitably be comparisons. We are sure Leandrin and those who went with her are dark friends. Black Aja. I would not see the same charge leveled at Elaine, and to protect her, it seems I must protect all of you. Tell me why you ran away, and what you have been doing these months, and I will do what I can for you." Her eyes fastened on Egwene like grappling hooks. Egwene floundered for an answer that the Aes Sedai would accept. It was said that Elida could hear a lie sometimes. It was Matt. He is very sick."
She tried to choose her words carefully, to say nothing that was not true, yet give an impression far from truth.
"Aes Sedai do it all the time," We went to... We brought him back to be healed. If we hadn't, he would die. The Amarlin is going to heal him, I hope.
She made herself continue to meet the red-eyed Sedai's gaze, willed herself not to shift her feet guiltily. From Elida's face, there was no way to tell whether she believed a word.
That is enough, Egwene, Nynaeve said.
Elida's penetrating look shifted to her, but she gave no sign of being affected by it. She met the Aes Sedai's eyes without blinking.
Forgive me for interrupting, Elida Sedai, she said smoothly,
but the Amarlin seat said our transgressions were to be put behind us and forgotten. As part of making a new beginning, we are not even to speak of them. The Amarlin said it should be as if they never happened.
She said that, did she?
Still nothing in Elida's voice or on her face told whether she believed or not.
Interesting. You can hardly forget entirely when your punishment has been announced to the entire tower.
Unprecedented, that. Unheard of, for less than stilling. I can see why you are eager to put it all behind you.
I understand you are to be raised to the accepted, Elaine.
And Egwene.
That is hardly punishment.
Elaine glanced at the Aes Sedai as though for permission to speak.
The mother said we were ready, she said. A touch of defiance entered her voice. I have learned, Elida Sedai, and grown. She would not have named me to be raised if I had not.
Learned, Elida said musingly.
And grown. Perhaps you have.
There was no hint in her tone whether she thought this was good. Her gaze shifted back to Egwene and Nynaeve, searching.
You returned with this mat. A youth from your village. There was another young man from your village, Randall Thor.
Egwene felt as if an icy hand had suddenly gripped her stomach.
I hope he is well, Nynaeve said levelly, but her hand was a fist gripping her braid.
We have not seen him in some time.
An interesting young man, Elida studied them as she spoke.
I met him only once, but I found him most interesting. I believe he must be Taviren.
Yes,
the answers to many questions may rest in him. This Emmons field of yours must be an unusual place to produce the two of you, and Randall Thor.
It is just a village, Nynaeve said.
Just a village like any other.
Yes, of course,
Elida smiled, a cold quirk of her lips that twisted Egwene's stomach. Tell me about him. The Amarlin has not commanded you to be silent about him also, has she?
Nynaeve gave her braid a tug.
Elaine studied the carpet as if something important were hidden in it, and Egwene racked her brain for an answer.
She can hear lies, they say. Light, if she can really hear a lie.
The moment stretched on, until finally Nynaeve opened her mouth. At that instant, the door opened again. Shiriam regarded the room with a measure of surprise.
It is well I find you here, Elaine. I want all three of you. I had not expected you, Elida.
Elida stood, arranging her shawl.
We are all curious about these girls. Why they ran away? What adventures they had while gone? They say the mother has commanded them not to speak of it.
As well not to, Shiriam said. They are to be punished, and that should be an end to it. I have always felt that when punishment is done, the fault that caused it should be erased. For a long moment the two Aes Sedai stood looking at each other, no expression on either smooth face. Then Elida said,
Of course. Perhaps I will speak to them another time, about other matters.
The look she gave to the three women in white seemed to Egwene to carry a warning, and then she was slipping past Shiriam. Holding the door open, the mistress of novices watched the other Aes Sedai go down the gallery. Her face was still unreadable. Egwene let out a long breath and heard echoes from Nynaeve and Elaine.
She threatened me, Elaine said incredulously and half to herself. She threatened me with stilling if I don't stop being willful.
You mistook her, Shiriam said.
If being willful were a stilling offense, the list of the stilled would have more names on it than you could learn. Few meek women ever achieve the ring and the shawl. That is not to say, of course, that you must not learn to act meekly when it is required.
Yes, Shiriam Sedai,
They all three said almost as one, and Shiryam smiled. You see, you can give the appearance of meekness at least, and you will have plenty of opportunity to practice before you earn your way back into the Ammerlin's good graces, and mine. Mine will be harder to achieve. Yes, Shiryam Sedai, Egwene said, but this time only Elaine spoke with her. Nynaeve said, What of the body, Shiryam Sedai? The soulless. Have you discovered who killed him, or why he entered the tower? Shiryam's mouth tightened. You take one step forward, Nynaeve, and then a step back. Since from Elaine's lack of surprise you have obviously told her of it, after I told you not to speak of the matter. Then there are exactly 7 people in the tower who know a man was killed today in the novices' quarters, and 2 of them are men who know no more than that, except that they are to keep their mouths shut. If an order from the Mistress of Novices carries no weight with you, and if that is so I will correct you, perhaps you will obey one from the Ammerlin seat. You are to speak of this to no one except the mother or me. The Ammerlin will not have more rumors piled on those we must already contend with. Do I make myself clear? The firmness of her voice produced a chorus of, Yes, Shiryam Sedai, but Nynaeve refused to stop at that. 7, you said, Shiryam Sedai, plus whoever killed him, and maybe they had help getting into the tower. That is no concern of yours. Shiryam's level gaze included them all. I will ask whatever questions must be asked about this man. You will forget you know anything at all about a dead man. If I discover you are doing anything else, well, there are worse things than scrubbing pots to occupy your attention, and I will not accept any excuses. Do I hear any more questions? No, Shiryam Sedai. This time Nynaeve joined in, to Egwene's relief. Not that she felt very much relief. Shiryam's watchful eye would make it doubly hard to carry out a search for the Black Aja. For a moment she felt like laughing hysterically. If the Black Aja doesn't catch us, Shiryam will. The urge to laugh vanished. If Shiryam isn't Black Aja herself. She wished she could make that thought go away. Shiryam nodded. Very well, then. You will come with me. To where? Nynaeve asked, and added, Shiryam Sedai, only an instant before the Aes Sedai's eyes narrowed. Have you forgotten, Shiryam said in a tight voice, that in the tower healing is always done in the presence of those who bring their sick to us? Egwene thought that the Mistress of Novices' stock of patience with them was about used up, but before she could stop herself she burst out, Then she is going to heal him. The Ammerlin seat herself, among others, will see to him. Shiryam's face held no more expression than her voice. Did you have reason to doubt it? Egwene could only shake her head. Then you waste your friend's life standing here. The Ammerlin's seat is not to be kept waiting. Yet despite her words, Egwene had the feeling the Aes Sedai was in no hurry at all. Chapter 18. Healing. Lamps on iron wall brackets lit the passages deep beneath the tower where Shiryam took them. The few doors they passed were shut tight, some locked, some so cunningly worked that they remained unseen until Egwene was right on top of them. Dark openings marked most of the crossing hallways, while down others she could only see the dim glow of distant lights spaced far apart. She saw no other people. These were not places even Aes Sedai often came. The air was neither cool nor warm, but she shivered anyway, and at the same time felt sweat trickling down her back. It was down here, in the depths of the White Tower, that novices went through their last test before being raised to accepted, or put out of the tower if they failed. Down here, accepted took the 3 oaths after passing their final test. No one, she realized, had ever told her what happened to an accepted who failed. Down here, somewhere, was the room where the tower's few Angreal and Sa'angreal were kept, and the places where the Tur-Angreal were stored. The Black Aja had struck at those storerooms, and if some of the Black Aja were lying in wait in one of those dark side corridors, if Shiryam were leading them not to Mat, but to... She gave a squeak when the Aes Sedai stopped suddenly, then colored when the others looked at her curiously. I was thinking about the Black Aja, she said weakly. Do not think of it, Shiryam said. And for once she sounded like the Shiryam of old, kindly if firm. The Black Aja will not be your worry for years to come. You have what the rest of us do not. Time before you must deal with it. Much time yet. When we enter, stay against the wall and keep silent. You are allowed here as a benevolence, to attend, not to distract or interfere. She opened a door covered in gray metal worked to look like stone. The square room within was spacious, its pale stone walls bare. The only furnishing was a long stone table draped with a white cloth in the middle of the room. Matt lay on that table, fully clothed, save for coat and boots, eyes closed and face so gaunt that Egwene wanted to cry. His labored breathing made a hoarse whistle. The Shadar Logoth dagger hung sheathed at his belt, the ruby capping its hilt seeming to gather light, so it glowed like some fierce red eye, despite the illumination of a dozen lamps, magnified by the pale walls and white-tiled floor. The Ammerlin seat stood at Matt's head, and Lyanna at his feet. Four Aes Sedai stood down one side of the table and three down the other. Shiriam joined the three. One of them was Verin. Egwene recognized Seraphel, another brown sister, and Alana Mosvani of the green Aja and Anaya of the blue, which was Moiraine's Aja. Alana and Anaya had each taught her some of her lessons in opening herself to the true source, in how to surrender to Saidar in order to control it. And between her first arrival in the White Tower and her departure, Anaya must have tested her 50 times to see if she was a dreamer. The tests had shown nothing one way or the other, but plain-faced, kindly Anaya, with that warm smile that was her only beauty, had kept calling her back for more tests, as implacable as a boulder rolling downhill. The rest were unknown to her, except for one cool-eyed woman she thought was a white. The Ammerlin and the Keeper wore their stoles, of course, but none of the others had anything to mark them out except great serpent rings and ageless Aes Sedai faces. None of them acknowledged the presence of Egwene and the other two by so much as a glance. Despite the outward calm of the women around the table, Egwene thought she saw signs of uncertainty, a tightness to Anaya's mouth, a slight frown on Alana's darkly beautiful face. The cool-eyed woman kept smoothing her pale blue dress over her thighs without seeming to realize what she was doing. An Aes Sedai Egwene did not know set a plain, polished wooden box, long and narrow, on the table and opened it. From its nest in the red silk lining, the Ammerlin took out a white fluted wand the length of her forearm. It could have been bone or ivory, but was neither. No one alive knew what it was made of. Egwene had never seen the wand before, but she recognized it from a lecture Anaya had given the novices, one of the few Sa'angreal and perhaps the most powerful that the tower possessed. Sa'angreal had no power of their own, of course. They were merely devices for focusing and magnifying what an Aes Sedai could channel. But with that wand, a strong Aes Sedai might be able to crumple the walls of Tar Valon. Egwene clutched Nynaeve's hand on one side and Elaine's on the other. Light. They're not sure they can heal him, even with a Sa'angreal. With that Sa'angreal! What chance would we have had? We'd probably have killed him and ourselves, too. Light. I will meld the flows, the Ammerlin said. Be careful. The power needed to break the bond with the dagger and heal its damage is very close to what could kill him. I will focus. Attend. She held the wand straight out in front of her in both hands, above Matt's face. Still unconscious, he took his head and tightened a fist on the dagger's hilt, muttering something that sounded like a denial. A glow appeared around each Aes Sedai, that soft white light that only a woman who could channel could see. Slowly the light spread until that which seemed to emanate from one woman touched that which came from the woman beside her, merged with it till there was only one light— a light that to Egwene's eyes diminished the lamps to nothing, and in that brightness was a stronger light still, a bar of bone-white fire, the Sa'angreal. Egwene fought the urge to open herself to Saidar and add her flow to the tide. It was a pull so strong she was about to be jerked off her feet. Elaine tightened her hold on her hand. Nynaeve took a step toward the table, then stopped with an angry shake of her head. Light, Egwene thought. I could do it. But she did not know what it was she could do. Light, it's so strong. It's so wonderful. Elaine's hand was trembling. On the table, Matt thrashed in the middle of the glow, jerking this way, then that, muttering incomprehensibly. But he did not loosen his hold on the dagger, and his eyes remained closed. Slowly, ever so slowly, he began to arch his back, muscles straining till he shook. Still he fought and bucked, until finally only his heels and his shoulders touched the table. His hand on the dagger sprang open, and quivering crept back from the hilt, was forced fighting from the hilt. His lips skinned away from his teeth in a snarl, a grimace of pain, and his breath came in forced grunts. "They are killing him," Egwene whispered. "The Ammerlin is killing him. We have to do something." Just as softly, Nynaeve said, "If we stop them, if we could stop them, he'll die. I do not think I could handle half that much of the power." She paused as if she had just heard her own words. That she could channel half of what 10 full Aes Sedai did with a Sa'angreal, and her voice grew even fainter. "Light help me, I want to." She fell silent abruptly. Did she mean that she wanted to help Matt, or that she wanted to channel that flow of power? Egwene could feel that urge in herself, like a song that compelled her to dance. "We must trust them," Nynaeve said in an intense whisper finally. "He has no other chance." Suddenly Matt shouted loud and strong, "Muadrin Tiadar Alende Kabadrin Radiem." Arched and struggling, eyes squeezed shut, he bellowed the words clearly. "Los Valdar Quebiari, Los Karai An Caldazar, Al Caldazar." Egwene frowned. She had learned enough to recognize the old tongue, if not to understand more than a few words. Karai An Caldazar, Al Caldazar. For the honor of the Red Eagle, for the Red Eagle. Ancient battle cries of Manetharan, a nation that had vanished during the Trolloc Wars, a nation that had stood where the Two Rivers was now. That much she knew, but in some way it seemed for a moment that she should understand the rest, too, as if the meaning were just out of sight and all she had to do was turn her head to know. With a loud pop of tearing leather, the golden sheath dagger rose from Matt's belt, hung a foot above his straining body. The ruby glittered, seemed to send off crimson sparks, as if it too fought the healing. Matt's eyes opened, and he glared at the women standing around him. "Mia Allende Aes Sedai, Kabalein Misainye, Inda Muagde Aes Sedai Misainye, Mia Allende!" And he began to scream, a roar of rage that went on and on, till Egwene wondered that he had breath left in him. Hurriedly, Anaya bent to lift a dark metal box from under the table, moving as if it were heavy. When she set it beside Matt and opened the lid, only a small space was revealed within sides at least 2 inches thick. Anaya bent again for a set of tongs such as a goodwife might use in her kitchen, and grasped the floating dagger in them as carefully as if it were a poisonous snake. Matt's scream grew frantic. The ruby shone furiously, flashing blood red. The Aes Sedai thrust the dagger into the box and snapped the lid down, letting out a loud sigh as it clicked shut. "A filthy thing," she said. As soon as the dagger was hidden, Matt's shriek cut off, and he collapsed as if muscle and bone had turned to water. An instant later, the glow surrounding Aes Sedai and table winked out. "Done," the Ammerlin said hoarsely, as if she had been the one screaming. "It is done." Some of the Aes Sedai sagged visibly, and sweat beaded on more than one brow. Anaya pulled a plain linen handkerchief from her sleeve and wiped her face openly. The cool-eyed white dabbed almost surreptitiously at her cheeks with a bit of Lugard lace. "Fascinating," Varen said, "that the old blood could flow so strongly in anyone today." She and Seraphel put their heads together, talking softly but with many gestures. "Is he healed?" Nynaeve said. "Will he live?" Matt lay as if sleeping, but his face still had that hollow-cheeked gauntness. Egwene had never heard of a healing that did not cure everything. Unless just separating him from the dagger took all of the power they used, light. "Brandas," the Ammerlin said, "will you see that he is taken back to his room?"
"As you command, mother,"
the cool-eyed woman said, her curtsy as emotionless as she herself seemed. When she left to summon bearers, several of the other Aes Sedai left too, including Anaya. Verin and Seraphel followed, still talking to one another too quietly for Egwene to make out what they said. "Is Matt all right?" Nynaeve demanded. Shiriam raised her eyebrows. The Armorland seat turned toward them. "He is as well as he can be," she said coldly. "Only time will tell. Carrying something with Shadar Logoth's taint for so long, who knows what effect it will have on him? Perhaps none, perhaps much. We will see. But the bond with the dagger is broken. Now he needs rest and as much food as can be gotten into him. He should live."
"What was that he was shouting, Mother?"
Elaine asked, then hastily added,
"If I may ask."
"He was ordering soldiers." The Armorlin gave the young man lying on the table a quizzical look. He had not moved since collapsing, but Egwene thought his breathing seemed easier, the rise and fall of his chest more rhythmic. "In a battle 2,000 years gone, I would say. The old blood comes again." "It was not all about a battle," Nynaeve said. "I heard him say Aes Sedai. That was no battle. Mother," she added belatedly. For a moment the Armorlin seemed to consider, perhaps what to say, perhaps whether to say anything. "For a time," she said firmly, "I believe the past and the present were one. He was there and he was here and he knew who we were. He commanded us to release him." She paused again. "I am a free man, Aes Sedai. I am no Aes Sedai meat. That is what he said." Lyanna sniffed loudly, and some of the other Aes Sedai muttered angrily under their breath.
"But Mother," Egwene said, "he could not have meant it as it sounds. Manetharan was allied with Tar Valon."
"Manetharan was an ally, child," the Amarlin told her. "But who can know the heart of a man? Not even he himself, I suspect. A man is the easiest animal to put on a leash, and the hardest to keep leashed, even when he chooses it himself."
"Mother," Shiriam said, "it is late. The cooks will be waiting for these helpers."
"Mother," Egwene asked anxiously, "could we not stay with Matt? If he may still die..." The Armorlin's look was level, her face without expression.
"You have chores to do, child." It was not scrubbing pots, she meant. Egwene was sure of that.
"Yes, Mother."
She curtsied, her skirts brushing Nynaeve's and Elaine's as they made theirs. One last time she looked at Matt, then followed Shiriam out. Matt had still not moved.
Chapter 19. Awakening. Matt opened his eyes slowly and stared up at the white plaster ceiling, wondering where he was and how he had come there. An intricate fringe of gilded leaves bordered the ceiling, and the mattress under his back felt plumped full of feathers. Somewhere rich, then. Somewhere with money. But his head was empty of the where and the how, and a lot more besides. He had been dreaming, and bits of those dreams still tumbled together with memories in his head. He could not separate one from the other. Wild flights and fights, strange people from across the ocean, ways and portal stones and pieces of other lives, things right out of a Gleeman's tales. These had to be dreams. At least he thought they must be. But Loyal was no dream, and he was an Ogier. Chunks of conversation drifted around in his thoughts, talks with his father, with friends, with Moraine, and a beautiful woman, and a ship captain, and a well-dressed man who spoke to him like a father giving sage advice. Those were probably real. But it was all bits and fragments, drifting.
"Muadrin tia dar alende kabadrin radiem," he murmured.
The words were only sounds, yet they sparked something. The packed lines of spearmen stretched a mile or more to either side below him, dotted with the pennants and banners of towns and cities and minor houses. The river secured his flank on the left, the bogs and mires on the right. From the hillside he watched the spearmen struggle against the mass of Trollocs trying to break through, 10 times the human's number. Spears pierced black Trolloc mail, and spiked axes carved bloody gaps in the human ranks. Screams and bellows harried the air. The sun burned hot overhead in a cloudless sky, and shimmers of heat rose above the battle line. Arrows still rained down from the enemy, slaying Trolloc and human alike. He had called his archers back, but the Dreadlords did not care so long as they broke his line. On the ridge behind him, the Heart Guard awaited his command, horses stamping impatiently. Armor on men and horses alike shone silver in the sunlight. Neither men nor animals could stand the heat much longer. They must win here or die. He was known as a gambler. It was time to toss the dice. In a voice that carried over the tumult below, he gave the order as he swung up into his saddle.
"Footmen, prepare to pass cavalry forward!"
His bannermen rode close beside him, the red eagle banner flapping over his head as the command was repeated up and down the line. Below, the spearmen suddenly moved, sidestepping with good discipline, narrowing their formations, opening wide gaps between. Gaps into which the Trollocs poured, roaring bestial cries like a black oozing tide of death. He drew his sword, raised it high.
"Forward, the Heart Guard!"
He dug his heels in, and his mount leaped down the slope. Behind him, hooves thundered in the charge.
"Forward!"
He was first to strike into the Trollocs, his sword rising and falling, his bannermen close behind.
"For the honor of the Red Eagle!"
The Heart Guard pounded into the gaps between the spearmen, smashing the tide, hurling it back.
"The Red Eagle!"
Half-human faces snarled at him. Oddly curved swords sought him, but he cut his way ever deeper. Win or die.
"Manetherin!"
Matt's hand trembled as he raised it to his forehead.
"Los Valda Quebiare," he muttered.
He was almost sure he knew what it meant. Forward the Heart Guard. Or maybe the Heart Guard will advance. But that could not be. Moraine had told him a few words of the old tongue, and those were all he knew of it. The rest might as well be magpie chatter.
"Crazy," he said roughly. "It probably isn't even the old tongue at all. Just gibberish. That Aes Sedai is crazy. It was only a dream." Aes Sedai. Moraine. He suddenly became aware of his too thin wrist and bony hand and looked at them. He had been sick. Something to do with a dagger. A dagger with a ruby in the hilt and a long-dead tainted city called Shadar Logoth. It was all foggy and distant and made no real sense, but he knew it was no dream. Egwene and Nynaeve had been taking him to Tar Valon to be healed. He remembered that much. He tried to sit up and fell back, as weak as a newborn lamb. Laboriously, he pulled himself up and shoved the single woolen blanket aside. His clothes were gone, perhaps in the vine-carved wardrobe standing against the wall. For the moment, he did not care about clothes. He struggled to his feet, tottered across the flowered carpet to cling to a high-backed armchair, and lurched from the chair to the table, gilded scrolls on its legs and edges. Beeswax candles, four to each tall stand, and small mirrors behind the flames, lit the room brightly. A larger mirror on the wall above the highly polished washstand threw his reflection back at him, gaunt and wasted, cheeks hollow and dark eyes sunken, hair sweat-matted, bent like an old man and wavering like pasture grass in a breeze. He made himself stand straight, but it was not much improvement. A large covered tray sat on the table in front of his hands, and his nose caught the smells of food. He twitched aside the cloth, revealing two large silver pitchers and dishes of thin green porcelain. He had heard that the sea folk charged its weight in silver for that porcelain. He had expected beef tea or sweetbreads, the kinds of things invalids had pushed on them. Instead, one plate held slices of a beef roast, piled thickly, with brown mustard and horseradish. On others, there were roasted potatoes, sweet beans with onions, cabbage, and butter peas. Pickles and a wedge of yellow cheese. Thick slices of crusty bread and a dish of butter. One pitcher was filled with milk and still beaded with condensation on the outside. The other with what smelled like spiced wine. There was enough of everything for four men. His mouth watered and his stomach growled at him. First, I find out where I am. But he rolled up a slice of beef and dipped it in the mustard before pushing himself away from the table toward the three tall, narrow windows. Wooden shutters carved in lacy patterns covered them, but through the holes he could see that it was night outside. Lights from other windows made dots in the blackness. For a moment he sagged against the white stone windowsill in frustration, but then he began to think. You can turn the worst that comes to your advantage if you only think, his father always said. And certainly Abel Cawthon was the best horse trader in the Two Rivers. When it seemed somebody had taken advantage of Matt's father, it always turned out they had gotten the greasy end of the stick. Not that Abel Cawthon ever did anything dishonest, but even Tarin Ferry folk never got the best of him, and everybody knew how close to the bone they cut. All because he thought about things from every side that there was. Tarvalin. It had to be Tarvalin. This room belonged in a palace. The flowered Domani carpet alone probably cost as much as a farm. More, he did not think he was sick any longer, and from what he had been told, Tarvalin was his only chance to get well. He had never actually felt sick, not that he remembered, not even when Varen, another name, swam out of the haze, had told someone nearby that he was dying. Now he felt weak as a babe and hungry as a starving wolf, but somehow he was sure the healing had been done. I feel well and whole. That's all. I've been healed. He grimaced at the shutters. Healed. That meant they had used the one power on him. The notion sent goosebumps marching across his skin, but he had known it would be done. Better than dying, he told himself. Some of the stories he had heard about Aes Sedai came back. It has to be better than dying. Even Nynaeve thought I was going to die. Anyway, it's done, and worrying about it now won't help anything. He realized he had finished the slice of beef and was licking its juice from his fingers. Unsteadily, he made his way back to the table. There was a stool underneath. He pulled it out and sat down. Not bothering with knife or fork, he made another roll of beef. How could he turn being in Tarvalin, in the White Tower, it has to be, to his advantage? Tarvalin meant Aes Sedai. That was certainly no reason to stay, even an hour. Exactly the opposite. What he remembered of his time with Moraine, and later with Varen, was not much to go on. He could not recall either of them doing anything really terrible, but then he could not recall a great deal of that time at all. Anyway, whatever Aes Sedai did, they did for their own reasons. And those aren't always the reasons you think they are, he mumbled around a mouthful of potato, then swallowed. An Aes Sedai never lies, but the truth an Aes Sedai tells you isn't always the truth you think it is. That's one thing I have to remember. I can't be sure about them, even when I think I know. It was not a cheering conclusion. He filled his mouth with butter peas. Thinking about Aes Sedai made him remember a little about them. There were seven Ajahs. Blue, red, brown, green, yellow, white, and gray. The reds were the worst, except for that black Ajah they all claim doesn't exist. But the red Ajah should be no threat to him. They were only interested in men who could channel. Rand. Burn me, how could I forget that? Where is he? Is he all right? He sighed regretfully and spread butter on a piece of still warm bread. I wonder if he's gone mad yet. Even if he knew the answers, he could do nothing to help Rand. He was not sure he would if he could. Rand could channel, and Matt had grown up with stories of men channeling, stories to frighten children. Stories that frightened adults, too, because some of them were all too true. Discovering what Rand could do had been like finding out his best friend tortured small animals and killed babies. Once you finally made yourself believe it, it was hard to call him a friend any longer. I have to look out for myself, he said angrily. He upended the wine pitcher over his silver cup and was surprised to find it empty. He filled the cup with milk instead. Egwene and Nynaeve want to be Aes Sedai.
He had not really remembered that until he said it aloud. Rand is following Moraine around and calling himself the Dragon Reborn. The Light knows what Perrin is up to. He's been acting crazy ever since his eyes turned funny. I have to look out for myself. Burn me, I have to. I'm the last one of us who's still sane. There's only me. Tarvalin. Well, it was supposed to be the wealthiest city in the world, and it was the center of trade between the Borderlands and the South, the center of Aes Sedai power. He did not think he could get an Aes Sedai to gamble with him, or trust the fall of the dice or the turn of the cards if he did. But there had to be merchants and others with silver and gold. The city itself would be worth a few days. He knew he had traveled far since leaving the Two Rivers, but aside from a few vague memories of Camelin and Kyrian, he could remember nothing of any great cities. He had always wanted to see a great city. "But not one full of Aes Sedai," he muttered sourly, scraping up the last of the butter peas. He gulped them down and went back for another helping of beef. Idly, he wondered if the Aes Sedai might let him have the ruby from the Shadar Logoth dagger. He remembered the dagger in only the fuzziest way, but even that was like remembering a terrible injury. His insides knotted up and sharp pain dug at his temples. Yet the ruby was clear in his mind, as big as his thumbnail, dark as a drop of blood, glittering like some crimson eye. Surely he had more claim to it than they did, and it had to be worth as much as a dozen farms back home. They'll probably say it is tainted too. And likely it was. Still, he spun a little fancy of trading the ruby to some of the Coplands for their best land. Most of that family, troublemakers from the cradle, where they were not thieves and liars as well, deserved whatever happened to them and more. But he really did not believe the Aes Sedai would give it back to him, did not relish the notion of carrying it as far as Emmons Field if they did. And the thought of owning the largest farm in the Two Rivers was no longer as exciting as it once had been. Once that had been his biggest ambition, that and to be known as his father's equal as a horse trader. Now it seemed such a small thing to want, a cramped thing, with the whole wide world just waiting out there. First off, he decided, he would find Egwene and Nynaeve. Maybe they've come to their senses. Maybe they've given up this foolishness about becoming Aes Sedai. He did not think they would have, but he could not go without seeing them. He would go, that was sure. A visit with them, a day to see the city, perhaps a game with the dice to pad out his purse, and then he would be off for somewhere where there were no Aes Sedai. Before he returned home, "I will go home one day. One day I will." He meant to see something of the world, and without any Aes Sedai making him dance to her tune. Rummaging around the tray for something more to eat, he was shocked to realize nothing was left but smears and a few crumbs of bread and cheese. The pitchers were both empty. He squinted down at his stomach in wonder. He should have been stuffed to the ears with all that in him, but he felt as if he had hardly eaten at all. He scraped the last bits of cheese together between thumb and forefinger. Halfway to his mouth, his hand froze. "I blew the horn of Elir." Softly, he whistled a bit of tune, then cut it short when the words came to him. "I'm down at the bottom of the well. It's night and the rain is coming down. The sides are falling in, and there's no rope to climb. I'm down at the bottom of the well." "There had better be a bloody rope to climb," he whispered. He let the cheese crumbs fall on the tray. For the moment, he felt sick again. Determinedly, he tried to think, tried to penetrate the fog that shrouded everything in his head. Varen had been bringing the horn to Tarvalin, but he could not remember if she knew he was the one who had blown it. She had never said anything to make him think so. He was sure of that. He thought he was. So what if she does know? What if they all do? Unless Varen did something with it I don't know about, they have the horn. They don't need me. But who could say what Aes Sedai thought they needed? "If they ask," he said grimly, "I never even touched it. If they know, I'll handle that when it comes. Burn me, they can't want anything from me. They can't." A soft knock on the door brought him swaying to his feet, ready to run. If there had been any place to run to, and if he could have managed more than 3 steps. But there was not, and he could not. The door opened. Chapter 20. Visitations. The woman who came in, dressed all in white silk and silver, shut the door behind her and leaned back against it to study him with the darkest eyes Matt had ever seen. She was so beautiful he almost forgot to breathe, with hair as black as night held by a finely woven silver band, and as graceful in repose as another woman would be dancing. He halfway thought that he knew her, but he rejected the idea out of hand. No man could ever forget a woman like her.
"You may be passable, I suppose, once you fill out again," she said. "But for now, perhaps you could put on something."
For an instant, Matt continued to stare at her. Then suddenly he realized he was standing there naked. Face scarlet, he shambled to the bed, pulled the blanket around himself like a cloak, and more fell than sat down on the edge of the mattress.
"I'm sorry for... I mean, I... That is, I didn't expect... I...
He drew a deep breath.
"I apologize for your finding me this way."
He could still feel the heat in his cheeks. For a moment he wished that Rand, whatever he had become, or even Perrin were there to advise him. They always seemed to get on well with women. Even girls who knew that Rand was all but promised to Egwene used to stare at him, and they seemed to think Perrin's slow ways were gentle and attractive. However hard he tried, he always managed to make a fool of himself in front of girls, as he had just done.
"I would not have visited you in this way, Matt, except that I was here in the White Tower."
She smiled as if the name amused her.
"For another purpose, and I wanted to see all of you."
Matt's face reddened again, and he tugged the blanket around him tighter, but she seemed not to have been teasing him. More graceful than a swan, she glided to the table.
"You are hungry. That's to be expected, the way they do things. Make sure you eat all they give you. You will be surprised at how quickly you put weight back and regain your strength."
Pardon, Matt said diffidently, "but do I know you? Meaning no offense, but you seem familiar."
She looked at him until he began to shift uneasily. A woman like her would expect to be remembered.
"You may have seen me," she said finally, "somewhere. Call me Celine."
Her head tilted slightly. She appeared to be waiting for him to recognize the name. It tugged at the edges of memory. He thought he must have heard it before, but he could not say when or where.
"Are you an Aes Sedai, Celine?" "No."
The word was soft, but surprisingly emphatic. For the first time, he studied her, able now to see more than her beauty. She was almost as tall as he was, slender and, he suspected from the way she moved, strong. He was not sure of her age, a year or two older than he, or maybe as much as 10, but her cheeks were smooth. Her necklace of smooth white stones and woven silver matched her wide belt, but she did not wear a great serpent ring. The absence should not have surprised him. No Aes Sedai would ever say right out that she was not. Yet it did. There was an air about her, a self-confidence, a surety in her own power to match any queen's, and something more, that he associated with Aes Sedai.
"You aren't by any chance a novice, are you?"
He had heard that novices wore white, but he could not really believe it of her.
"She makes Elaine look like a cringer. Elaine."
Another name drifting into his head.
"Hardly that," Celine said with a wry twist to her mouth. "Let us just say that I am someone whose interests coincide with yours. These Aes Sedai mean to use you. But you will like it in the main, I think, and accept it. There is no need to convince you to seek out glory."
"Use me?" The memory returned to him of thinking that, but about Rand,
that the eye said I meant to use Rand, not him.
They've no bloody use for me. Like they can't have.
What do you mean? I'm no one important. I'm no use to anyone but myself. What kind of glory?
I knew that would pull you. You above all.
Her smile made his head spin. He scrubbed a hand through his hair. The blanket slipped, and he caught it hastily before it could fall.
Now listen, they are not interested in me. What about me sounding the horn? I am just a farmer. Maybe they think I'm tied to Rand in some way. No, Varen said.
He was not sure what Varen had said, or Moraine, but he thought most Aes Sedai knew nothing at all about Rand. He wanted to keep it that way, at least until he was a long way gone.
Just a simple country, man. I only want to see a little of the world and go back to my Da's farm.
What does she mean, glory? Celine shook her head as if she had heard his thoughts.
You are more important than you yet know. Certainly more important than these so-called Aes Sedai know. You can have glory, if you know enough not to trust them.
You certainly sound as if you don't trust them.
So-called? A thought came to him, but he could not manage to say it.
Are you...
It was not the kind of thing you accused someone of.
A dark friend,
Celine said mockingly. She sounded amused, not angered. She sounded contemptuous.
One of those pathetic followers of Baal Zaman who think he will give them immortality and power? I follow no one. There is one man I could stand beside, but I do not follow.
Matt laughed nervously.
Of course not. Blood and ashes. A dark friend wouldn't name herself dark friend. Probably has a poisoned knife if she is.
He had a vague memory of a woman dressed as one nobly born, a dark friend with a deadly dagger in her slender hand.
That wasn't what I meant at all. You look like a queen. That's what I meant. Are you a lady?
Matt, you must learn to trust me. Oh, I will use you too.
You have too suspicious a nature, especially since carrying that dagger for me to deny it. But my use will gain you wealth and power and glory. I will not compel you. I have always believed men perform better if convinced rather than forced. These Aes Sedai do not even realize how important you are, and he will try to dissuade or kill you. But I can give you what you desire.
He, Matt said sharply. Kill me? Light, it's Rand thereafter, not me. How does she know about the dagger? I suppose the whole tower knows. Who wants to kill me?
Celine's mouth tightened as if she had said too much.
You know what you want, Matt, and I know it every bit as well as you. You must choose who you will trust to gain it for you. I admit I will use you. These Aes Sedai will never do that. I will lead you to wealth and glory. They will keep you tied to a leash until you die.
You say a lot, Matt said. But how do I know any of it is true? How do I know I can trust you any more than I can them?
By listening to what they tell you and what they do not.
Will they tell you your father came to Tar Valon?
My Da was here?
A man called Abul Cawthon, and another named Tam Althor. They made nuisances of themselves until they gained an audience, I have heard, wanting to know where you and your friends were. And Swan Sanche sent them back to the Two Rivers with empty hands, not even letting them know you were alive. Will they tell you that, unless you ask? Perhaps not even then, for you might try to run away back home.
My Da thinks I am dead, Matt said slowly.
He can be told you live, I can see to it. Think on who to trust, Matt Cawthon. Will they tell you that even now Randall Thor is trying to escape, and the one called Moraine is hunting him? Will they tell you that the Black Adja infests their precious white tower? Will they even tell you how they mean to use you? Rand is trying to escape, but...
Maybe she knew Rand had proclaimed himself the Dragon Reborn, and maybe she did not, but he would not tell her.
The Black Adja? Blood and bloody ashes. Who are you, Selene? If you're not Aes Sedai, what are you?
Her smile hid secrets. Just remember that there is another choice. You need not be a puppet for the White Tower or pray for Baalzaman's dark friends. The world is more complex than you can imagine. Do as these Aes Sedai wish for the present, but remember your choices. Will you do that?
I don't see that I have much choice at all, he said glumly. I suppose I will.
Selene's look sharpened. Friendliness sloughed off her voice like an old snakeskin.
Suppose? I did not come to you like this, talk in this way for suppose, Matrim Cawthon.
She stretched out a slim hand. Her hand was empty, and she stood halfway across the room, but he leaned back, away from her hand, as if she were right on top of him with a dagger. He did not know why, really, except that there was a threat in her eyes, and he was sure it was real. His skin began to tingle, and his headache returned. Suddenly, tingle and pain vanished together, and Selene's head whipped around as if listening to something beyond the walls. A tiny frown appeared on her face, and she lowered her hand. The frown vanished.
We will talk again, Matt. I have much to say to you. Remember your choices. Remember that there are many hands that would kill you. I alone guarantee you life and all you seek, if you do as I say.
She slipped out of the door as silently and gracefully as she had entered. Matt let out a long breath. Sweat ran down his face.
Who in the light is she?
A dark friend, perhaps. Except that she had sounded as contemptuous of Baalzaman as she was of Aes Sedai. Dark friend spoke of Baalzaman the way anyone else might speak of the Creator. And she had not asked him to conceal her visit from the Aes Sedai.
Right, he thought sourly. Pardon me, Aes Sedai, but this woman came to see me. She wasn't Aes Sedai, but I think maybe she started to use the One Power on me, and she said she wasn't a dark friend. But she did say you mean to use me and the Black Ajahs in your tower. Oh, and she said I'm important. I don't know how. You don't mind if I leave now, do you?
Going was beginning to be a better idea by the minute. He slid awkwardly off the bed and made his way unsteadily to the wardrobe, still clutching his blanket around him. His boots were on the floor inside, and his cloak hung from a peg under his belt, with pouch and sheathed belt knife. It was just an ordinary country knife with a stout blade, but it could do as much as any fine dagger. The rest of his clothes, two sturdy wool coats, three pairs of breeches, half a dozen linen shirts and small clothes, had been brushed or washed as required and neatly folded on the shelves that took up one side of the wardrobe. He felt the pouch hanging from the belt, but it was empty. Its contents lay jumbled on a shelf with what had been emptied from his pockets. He brushed aside a red hawk's feather, a smooth, striped rock he had liked the colors of, his razor and his bone-handled pocket knife, and freed his wash-leather purse from some coils of spare bowstring. When he tugged it open, he found his memory had been all too good in this instance. 2 silver marks and a handful of copper, he muttered. I won't get far on that. Once it would have seemed a small fortune to him, but that had been before he left Emmons Field. He stopped to peer back into the shelf.
Where are they?
He began to be afraid the Aes Sedai might have thrown them out, the way his mother would if she had ever found them.
Where?
He felt a surge of relief. Way in the back, behind his tinderbox and ball of twine for snares and the like, were his 2 leather dice cups. They rattled as he pulled them out, but he still popped off the tight-fitting round caps. Everything was as it should be. 5 dice carved with symbols for crowns, and 5 marked with spots. The spotted dice would do for a number of games, but more men seemed to play crowns than anything else. With these, his 2 marks would be enough to take him far away from Tar Valon.
Away from Aes Sedai and Selene both.
A peremptory knock was followed immediately by the door opening. He whirled around. The Armelin Seat and the Keeper of the Chronicles were entering. He would have recognized them even without the Armelin's broad-striped stole and the Keeper's